This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Well, good morning and welcome to Jikoji. It's a wonderful January day. It should be raining, ideally, but we have a break. And hope for the best, hope for more rain. This morning's topic will be emotions, and particularly the five hindrances of Buddhism, why we have them, what they do, how to take care of them, and what they have to do with practice and society. So that's a lot. And I'm really following a book by, not really following, but paralleling a book by Robert Wright, which is called Why Buddhism is True. And it's about the his experience, I guess he got into Vipassana meditation about 3 or 4 years ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, but became quite intensively involved in it. He's a science writer and a professor. He's written books about God and religion, and he teaches subjects like neurobiology and psychology, evolutionary psychology as well. So his title is suggestive of Buddhism particularly, and how it relates to the other religions, and religions in general, and his experience in finding it true to his needs, and to his other religion of science, which I share. His context in that is not the Buddhism of reincarnation or other realms. It's the connotation or the context of science and mystical traditions, the luminous and the numinous that we all sort of come in contact with, and most religions call God in terms of their experience and their understanding and behavior. But we also, thank you. There's, I think, almost universally within religions, there's an unseen order or a perception of unseen order. Somehow the universe is not random or not meaningless, at least from our perceptions, but is instead it has this quality that we can deal with, and also the underlying supposed numinous quality, the light and the depth that we can get into. And we see that relative to our ordinary mind or our ordinary existence, that there is some depths in all religions. I think Christianity is the dominant religion, and there's something like 2 billion Christians, maybe 4 billion if you add up all the different Christian sects. After that, there's Islam at 1.2 billion, and Buddhism comes in a distant sixth, less than 500,000. And of that, our tradition, Zen, probably is in the millions, because we know that at least books sell into the millions, Suzuki Roshi's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which I will cite and quote from many times, I think, is has that sales volume, which is pretty amazing that we have so much influence. Buddhism in general has a disproportionate influence, I think, because it's true. And it's one headline about this book and a discussion of this book was titled How Science is Catching Up with Buddhism. So it's essentially what we're finding in common, particularly in evolutionary psychology, between Buddhism and science. The nexus, or the coming together, or the conflicts and convergence. And even the Dalai Lama's statement, he has greatly encouraged the pursuit of science investigation in terms of this, and has said that if there's a conflict, Buddhism will bow and accept. So that's where we're coming from. Zen was called, I think, by Suzuki Roshi, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind again, as a religion before religion. So it's a part of Buddhism, but it maybe is something of prerequisite, and it doesn't entail necessarily adherence to Buddhism per se. Many of us have different religions. We're coming from different places. And yet the practice of Zen is appropriate and meaningful and actually pretty effective. It works pretty well. So Zen practice in general is here and now. It's what we're doing and what we do in our lives. Here, we do it through forms and ceremonies. This is not our norm, but it's still very effective. And it's millennia old. The what of Zen is just to live. Live your life, learn, change as appropriate. Who is us? We're doing it. We're it. But not you. The you being the internal experiential you, who tends to maybe drift off and analyze or think a bit or plan or scheme or remember or get into your emotions and be looking towards something more than we can deliver. You may be a little bit dissatisfied, unsatisfied with your experience now because of that. Why we're doing this is because without religion actually, there is suffering. There's also joy. But the suffering is coming back to the five hindrances that we're talking about. It's due to the five hindrances in large part, in good part. And the joy is in Zazen. Dogen said something like, Zazen is the Dharma gate of peace and joy. The Dharma is the truth in general, main topic. The gate is the way into that. There are many, many gates for the Dharma. But Zazen is perhaps the easiest and most, certainly very effective. So when we talk about Zen, what I mean is probably encapsulated in three words that I'd like you to remember, and that's just sit upright. Those words have layers of meanings, and eventually they disappear. But a little bit about them. To sit Zazen, we sit cross-legged in the cushion, if possible. It's vital for the support during Zazen of the body. And then, according to Suzuki Roshi, it supports one's mind. Or it confuses one's mind so that your normal default mode of thinking is a little bit difficult to do if you're aware that you're sitting in the cross-legged position. According to Suzuki Roshi also, there's no need to find any special state of mind in this posture. If you're upright sitting with the right posture, you're good. If you cannot be satisfied with your practice of Zazen. He says it's probably due to your mind's wandering, discursive thoughts, afflictive emotions, etc., that happen continuously. So that's how to sit Zazen. The upright has the meaning of straight back, stretched spine, generally pulled your chin back to try to lift the top back of the head and arch your back. Your mouth is closed, your tongue is up against the front teeth, up against the top of the mouth, and you generally try to swallow any saliva so there's no feeling of air or vacancy in your mouth. And the latter, according to Koban, I've never quite understood why it's important to swallow your saliva or not to retain saliva, but I do notice that it's associated with drifting in my mind. So if I could, a little departure on that. Koban, the founder of this temple, 50 years ago, told me how to sit upright in pretty much those terms. And my reaction is, because I was anxious, young, and impatient, that's not what I understand about meditation. I can't do that. And I just rejected it. I think it cost me maybe 40 or 50 years not to have just accepted that. I apologize. Another sense of uprightness in sitting is reflected in the precepts, our sort of guides to conduct, not killing, not stealing, not lying, etc. And there's a book by Reb Anderson called Being Upright. So that deals in depth with the precepts, but it also stresses the importance of being upright as a way of life. Again, all these words disappear pretty quickly and you're still back to living. The just sit upright. The just is reflecting of freedom, justice, and liberty for all. It's my little bird here. But it also means just this. What we are ultimately is just this. We have, hopefully, our practice leads us to having small desires and knowing how much is enough, and we're able to regulate our lives. But I reflect back to there's a saying carved in one of the Dana boxes at the entrance to Santa Cruz Zen Center, which I really love. It's called, "Just yourself, this is enough." So just sit upright, but more important, just yourself. That's what we need. So the final aspect of this three-word shortcut to Zazen and practice in Zazen is to return. You will invariably discover that your mind is wandering, or that you're thinking or regretting or taking care of something in your mind or doing something. And what all Buddhist meditative practices prescribe is something called rain, which is to take that moment when you recognize that your mind is wandering and that you had the original aspiration and inspiration to sit quietly, peacefully, joyfully, and to bring your mind back to the present by recognizing the situation of your mind. Mind is actually mind-heart. All feelings and all emotions are sort of intertwined, and almost all thought, at least in my experience, is stimulated by some emotion. So you have that emotional thinking connection, and you need to investigate a little bit what it was that caused you to be thinking or feeling, and identify that in some way that you can accept but not identify with. So recognize, accept, investigate, and not identify are the Buddhist prescription for handling discursiveness. A couple of other thoughts I think that might help in that returning particularly is William James' statement about a century or a little bit more ago, that bringing your attention back over and over again to your situation, including your aspiration and inspiration for being here, is the only way to really begin to affect your tendencies, your natural tendencies, which we'll get into why you have those tendencies. Dogen said also, Zazen has nothing to do with sitting or lying down. So in contrast to the sit upright, just sit upright, Zazen is not something that just you walk away from. It's something that remains and is more significant to you. I suggest that's part of returning. And what you return to, we sometimes talk about as original nature or true nature or Buddha nature. What you were given before you actually went through puberty, even earlier, when you began to discover language and all the mind's paraphernalia dealing with that situations. But just yourself, this is what you're given to begin with. And what we hope to return to. So it would be unfair to just go on, which is what my tendency is, to why, the topic of the book. But I should mention first, we I think in November, Jen led a talk and a discussion on altered states and altered traits, altered states of consciousness. As a Zen embraces those also, we do through practices like sesshin, which are intensive meditation rather than just meditation. We sit for, in this coming sesshin, Nihani Sesshin, starting, I think, the first week in, or the second week in February. First?
Well, it's Friday, excuse me, Friday the 8th.
Thank you. We sit for up to 7 days, and we sit mostly in alternating Zazen, Kinhin talks, discussions, breaks for meals and so on, but we do that for 7 continuous days, so continuous practice. And this facilitates generally what we call concentration, and that happens in terms of experiences that you can, that will change you. And they're experiences of great insight, maybe, of changes in your mental habits, thinking, feeling, some reflections of the numinous, the luminous, some sacredness underlying it all. That comes more readily through the intensive practice than perhaps through the day-to-day practice. It also entails some things we call kensho, sudden changes, sudden inspirations. Satori sometimes, if you're very advanced and very lucky. Or enlightenments. I like to call them enlightenments because enlightenment is sometimes referred to in terms of Buddha's enlightenment. It's a great supreme thing that happens and that is enduring. But through intensive practice, we find many little bits and pieces of when Suzuki Roshi said of this, when we sit, we are nothing. We do not even realize what we are. But when we get up, we resume our normalcy. Koban said, one must disappear in the sitting. It is the only way. I think both refer to samadhi, to intensive sitting, to intensive practice. But also, you feel it in your normal zazen. What you feel in your zazen is important, and it's significant. And feeling that you are nothing is probably not what most of you have been experiencing for the last couple of periods of zazen. With my mind, it goes back and forth quite frequently, and I get into doing what I want to do. Why do I want things so badly? Why am I desirous, is the analysis. I don't, you know, part of it's to have something to say, which I hope to have. But part of it is innate. But when we get up, we return to normalcy. And in Zen, there's a koan that centuries ago that was when one monk asked another teacher what the way was, he said, ordinary mind is the way. That is, when you come back to your normal social interaction, you're back to where you were and are, but you're also changing continuously. So, Suzuki Roshi said, you are perfect just as you are. So that's just yourself is enough. You're perfect to begin with. But you could stand some improvement. So it fits pretty well my experience of children, when I had children, that somehow that defied all logic. You know, there's a million things that go into a particular child's character or being, maybe an ungodly, uncalculable number. And yet, he is perfect, or she is perfect, and she could stand some improvement. Another thing to say is that in that part of zazen is no gaining ideal. We're not trying to get ahead. We're not trying to do anything particular. But we acknowledge that there's a lot of things that happen in zazen. And another caution is that excitement is actually bad for you. So when I look at my children or my adult children now or my even all of my peers and colleagues, the excitement of devices is something that becomes an addiction. Mine is to chess and playing chess sometimes on devices. It completely absorbs me. But it's not good for me. Overall, it takes me away from the here and now. So back to evolution and why Robert Wright particularly beautifully articulated why we are where we are. And the hindrances of greed, anger, delusion are forefront in that. But also slothfulness, laziness, and in my case, anxious worry. And also doubt. But doubt I embrace because I think it has a solid tradition in the background of science. So we need to look at some truths and investigate them, is how Buddhism puts that. But evolution, you know, if you think back in terms of where is really evolution coming from, you think back into a very primitive organism, probably long before humans, some kind of mobile slime or collection of cells. And how it was moving, there's two poles. One is attraction, usually food. So it moves toward that pole. And the other is aversion, maybe sensing danger. So it moves away. So way back in evolution, those were perhaps the first two singular realization of a life form. Those two emotions came to help it navigate. And evolution's overall objective, of course, was just to propagate and spread the genes of that life form. So I wanted it to succeed, and those were the strategies. But the moving toward can be done in great excess. That's called grasping, greed for humans. And it comes about perhaps because the more we could get, the better off we are, the better our chances were surviving. Also, there's part of that is lust or sexual reproduction. And they're all together in a complex of emotions of moving and grasping and attaching yourself to something, which you're not. You're really free. You're just yourself. But in our thinking, particularly in our language, we're caught up in that. Anger is a more powerful, maybe, or certainly a very powerful emotion that came from the need to survive, to maintain life in the face of a threat. So fight. And what happens in humans is adrenaline and a lot of other hormones come together in a very, very complicated way. I have to stop for a statistic. We have something like 35 trillion cells in each of our bodies and 100 billion neurons, so unimaginable complexity of how those are all interrelated and orchestrated and what state they're in. So you yourself, each moment is sort of a miracle in terms of, you know, the improbability of what you're actually thinking, doing, feeling, experiencing, and moving toward or away from. It's very, very complicated. We went through another book called Behavior, which was by a man named Sapolsky, Robert Sapolsky, and it's Behave, I guess. And it traced all those factors coming back from your evolutionary roots to the genes that you inherited for your family, the social programming that we get through our language and our mutual understanding and our social interaction, and also from the immediate environment of hormones and so on. And they all combine, and they're strongly influenced by these very primitive emotions of anger, greed. And delusion was exemplified by what you do if you think you see a snake. Mostly you're wrong. There aren't that many snakes around. But your mind recognizes snake pretty easily, particularly in hunter-gatherer civilizations of a few hundred thousand years ago, 100,000, 10,000. So your mind is designed to react immediately. You immediately have this flush of action. And it does that through fight, flight, or freeze reactions that are part of almost all beings, all sentient beings. And it's strongly reflected in our immediate behavior. Another example that is easy is road rage. You get into a situation where you're cut off or where somebody needlessly interferes with you, and you become angry and you want to get back at that guy. That's totally in defiance of reason, because you'll never see that guy again, most likely if you're lucky. And what will happen is you'll eventually mitigate that, moderate that emotion, and come back to your agenda in driving. But it still happens, and it's still immediate and strong, and it influences us. We see that in politics also, of rage, because our turf, our property, is somehow involved in or invaded. And yet, it's not being invaded. It's changing. We don't even own the turf. Coben said something like, nothing belongs to me, not even my body. But this sense of belonging is very much built into our biology, our neurology. So by and large, our emotions are either positive or negative. They're also neutral. A lot of things just didn't matter to us. But we still take them in through our senses, and they go through some stages of processing. The processing is probably down 10 orders of magnitude below consciousness, so you never really are aware of it. And your mind is really getting a lot of sensory inputs from yourself, from your introspection. And it's trying to make sense of them in some way that we understand through now neurology and evolutionary psychology as modules of the mind competing. A lot of subconscious modules in your mind that are looking for a solution, for understanding of why, what's happening now, and one eventually succeeds. It's what happens in evolution also, but it happens internally. So you have many different tendencies concurrently operating in you. And all those influence your behavior, but some winning emotion, maybe the strongest emotion, maybe the rage, maybe the fear, takes over and you react. We call that, that's generally judgments that are without thought. They're often wrong, but they're statistically effective, as in the example of a snake. You may be wrong 99% of the time when you think you see a snake, but the overall evolutionary mechanism saves you on that 100th time when it actually is a dangerous snake. So evolution didn't care about being right. It cared about being effective, propagating genes. It's also true that in our being, somehow these emotions are incredibly valuable, and they're actually a dharma gate, if you will, an entry to the luminous, numinous realm, and probably connected to them in ways that science couldn't even begin to approach. But love, for example, and our kindness, compassion. It's all part of our culture, and it's deeply built into us, and it comes from somewhere. So maybe a source, the source. There was a book, well anyway, one statement that I saw recently was that the greatest truths that we know of, and truth is basically what we're seeking, it's synonymous with source, at least in a lot of my usages. People use it in a lot of different ways, so it's, like many names, just completely useless. But truth is what we're after. But even without affect, without feeling, without some context, it becomes just a platitude. The greatest truth becomes a platitude. It's totally meaningless to you. So it's only the feeling that you get that somehow drives your thinking, possibly subconsciously, is what can save you, what can help you, what provides your inspiration and aspiration. So So the three things that Robert White identifies, sort of summarizing the major emotions, is that they're not designed to be right, just effective in terms of evolution. He gives the analogy of an anxious hunter who needs quick judgments, who needs to scan the horizon always, not being drawn to the here and now, but instead to all the potential of shadows and appearances and maybe a deer or something that he really needs. They're not close to modern needs. The fight, flight, and freeze is not usually what we need to do. Sometimes, but very exceptional. In terms of anxiety, however, my affliction, and evolution's maybe key goal was to make us a little bit anxious, not happy, not really enjoying or peaceful or good, but anxious so that we could secure any possible advantages might pop up on the horizon. We want to be looking for that, scanning for that. That's a strength in some sense. It's particularly a strength in modern society's management. There's a study recently that proved that the people who tend to be a little bit guilty and a little bit anxious tend to make the best managers. They have the strongest conscience and they're more attentive to what's going to happen overall. The third major aspect is there's no lasting satisfaction. And that's because of another factor, that we are deluded in our minds. We'll go into next a little bit. But as soon as we get where we're going, maybe to a life's goal, maybe to some stage of enlightenment, maybe to getting that $1 million bonus or that recognition that we anxiously want, the satisfaction disappears. And evolution's command is, okay, what's next? That's all you get. The key delusions implicated in our suffering, the reason that we're not able to be peaceful and loving in our ordinary day-to-day life, are maybe some examples. One is the example that I've just become what I've always been wanting to be. I've just become what I will always be versus the affect. You know that you're changing. You know that you've always been changing. You know, looking back at your history, it's a history of change. And in that, there is identification of some other very great delusion that there is a permanent, non-changing basis called I or me. Or me, 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 me. It's all about me, the stories in this world. The whole universe is about me. I am the universe, which contains some truth. But it's overall a delusion. It's one that causes us to not pay attention, to not really be mindful. Another key delusion is essentialism. When I look out, I see the essentials of various people in the audience, or what I see as the essentials. I don't really see what they are. I try to recognize them. I'm built to recognize and to ascribe, so from evolution. So I see some character, like my wife or my teacher, or our Doan. and we think that we know what that is. But even I don't know what I am. There's really no telling what you are. You're, again, the 35 billion cells, trillion cells, the 100 billion neurons, the infinite complexity of all their interconnections and all their orchestration happening. Homeostasis is what's happening. The being takes care of itself. It's learned to do that through evolution and through basic instinct for self-preservation. It's the essential ingredient of spreading your genes. So that sometimes called in Buddhism anatta or anatman, no self. There really is, although we always think and act, and when we go back to our normal way of relating socially, I'm doing this, I'm going to lunch, I'm going to join you in this afternoon's activities in my ordinary state of mind. But there is no I. It's just what's happening. So I brought my bird along to illustrate that. In part, the bird is from my wife's participation in the Women's March in Santa Cruz about a week ago, and it's been sitting on our dining room table, so I picked it up and brought it along. But in terms of the affect of Zazen, what are you? Well, if you think I and I'm just coming back, I realize that I've been discursing, but now I'm sure that I'm back paying attention, being Zazen, working at Zazen. Be the change. Maybe you're not what you think you are. Maybe you're the change in this process. And a further instance of change is the change in terms of mathematics. There's only one function that's actually equal to its change. I'll leave that to you to look up in Google. But it's a function whose derivative is equal to itself. And therefore, there's an infinite sequence of this. You can go into an infinite recursion of if you're the change, then you can look at the change in the change, or if you're the change of the change, you can look at that. In short, it's a matter of method of inquiry, being the change, but you're not going to get there because there's no end, no beginning. It's an infinite, doubly infinite sequence. It's also true that the integral of that function is itself, the indefinite integral. It's a whole family of functions because you can multiply it by any constant and you still get the same properties. So something to look up. The understanding that we are fundamentally not rational people, not fully rational, was initially pioneered by a man named Kahneman about two decades ago. And he came up with a number of very popular, simple psychological experiments that established reasonable proof that we were operating within a number of ongoing fallacies in our mind continuously. We're always having these illusions. One of them, he called it the System 1 versus System 2. The automatic, immediate, no judgment, you're there, you're sure, you're confident, you know it, but you're wrong 90% of the time. And the second is System 2. System 1 is automatic, System 2 is moderated by reason, by thinking. And it's generally better, you get a better result, but it's also irrational. And it's plagued by a number of other delusions that we have, which are, one is called the planning effect. If you're ever planning a project, you're going to conclude that it's going to take you much less than it will actually take you if you get into it, and it'll cost a lot less. And demonstrated in every aspect of government, people say it's going to cost us and get done in a certain amount of time. It doesn't happen. The endowment effect, you value what you have, what you're given, much higher than you'd value comparable things that you don't have. And yet you could trade them, but you still want your stuff. Risk aversion. You won't bet an even bet for $100 because you want to keep your $100, even though you might have 200 in general. And the status quo bias is along the same line. We want to maintain. Maybe all this comes from homeostasis, trying to maintain your own status, even though there's no real I or me. Finally, many cognitive biases. That we have. Now going back to Kahneman, System 1 and System 2, System 1 being the automatic, System 2 being with thought. I think it's fairly well established, but I'm not sure of this, so just take it as my hypothesis, that even System 2 is frequently wrong, and that meditation can go deeper, can give you a better basis for understanding, particularly if you analyze your feelings and where it's coming from. So we find that meditation through long-term practice of meditation, and that's why we meditate. And it's not necessarily just our tradition. It works for across a broad range of traditions, many, many others, not just Buddhism. In terms of the analysis of feelings, when they arise, there are links of causation in Buddhism, I think 12 dependent causation links or something like that. But the links, I think, start with senses or sensation and go on to perception and then feeling. Perception is something where you come up with something. Feeling is sort of what is associated with that. So those are always together and frequently wrong. And meditation does sponsor or entail moderate your feelings, give you a little deeper insight, and provide a clearer view of both yourself internally, what's happening internally, and the outside world, because of your knowledge of yourself, moderates all your views. You're actually, every time you do anything, you're continuously changing, and your brain is changing, and your mind is changing. But through certain practices of meditation, we can prove that the structure of the mind, the actual physical structure and interconnections get changed through particularly long-term practices. So we have the altered states when we're zazen sitting. Just sitting is a little bit different than our normal state of consciousness. But we also have the altered traits. We know that this practice over time helps and moderates our more strong feelings. So I'm not sure what time it is. I have a list of 12 Buddhist truths that I'd like to go through. And a headline from New York Times that said, "You should meditate every day." That's the strongest statement I've seen in a long time. You should meditate every day.
The headline for an article.
You're what?
The headline for an article.
I'm still not.
Not the headline of the entire newspaper. The headline for an article, not the entire newspaper.
No, it wasn't the top.
Yeah.
It was just an article. But it is symptomatic, I think, of a drumbeat, a growing trend throughout society, particularly American society, but also through Western society, of the increasing recognition that meditation is essential to mental health and well-being. And it's a strong contributor to that. I don't know what time it is, so...
12:43?
That's too long. I'm sorry. I apologize. I should have left some time for discussion, but that gives me time for one commercial, which is that...
We started a bit late, so you can probably go on for a little while. Another 5 minutes or so.
Oh, okay.
We started a little late.
Great, thank you. That's from our chef, Doug, who's nobly doing what's important toward this practice. He's making lunch. So I do have a few minutes. I just wanted to say that there's a strong tradition. When I grew up, emotions were sort of the heroic era of the end of the Second World War and the building of modern America. And it was, emotions are nowhere. It was totally unimportant. And it, after that, there came a generation when self-love became the focus of a lot of teaching, particularly grade school teaching, teaching the children to appreciate themselves, because in the original heroic tradition, you just completely dismissed yourself. Your duty was important. And the self-love has fallen away to something called self-indifference, sort of not taking yourself too seriously, otherwise known as humility. So these are happening too. We've gone through a tradition where we value ourselves and our desires above everything else, but particularly through meditation, we're into a bit more humility in our particular perspectives. So I again apologize for taking too long. I did want to say that there's a discussion period for starting at 2:00 if anyone wants to discuss any of this material. And it's open to anyone. There's no particular background entailed or wanted. And your opinions are as good as, probably better than most other people. So you'd be most welcome then. Any...
The theme is
this book in a little bit more detail. Why Buddhism is True. Maybe some readings from the book if people don't have better things to do. But... They give a nice summary of the 12 truths of Buddhism, for example, which might teach us a little bit more about Buddhism in an appendix, and so on. But I think, I'm not sure that the discussion will go that way. It's open. So, and no facilitator, no leader so far. So it's what happens. Yes?
While discussing Sashin's, you mentioned Satori and enlightenment. I had the idea that both refer to the same thing, but is that not the case?
I don't think if you have the Satori experience in Sashin or in any other part of your life that you will have Buddha's enlightenment. So far we've got a sample of 2,500 years of Zen teachers who have dedicated their lives. There's been a lot of Satori mixed throughout those. But they're not necessarily transcending Buddha. Maybe they're not even the same as Buddha in their internal experience versus their external experience. Maybe they continue to be suffer from evolution's inheritance in some ways. So we've seen examples of teachers who've gotten in trouble and seriously harmed others. And it's a random kind of thing. On the average, we think that the Satori contributes to enlightenment. But there is some Buddhist enlightenment may have been, I'm so far down on the scale, I can't even begin to guess what his life was like, what he was like. Yes, I won't be able to hear you, but maybe Michael will kindly answer, or someone else.
I try to speak up.
Thank you.
I sometimes feel other people know me better than I know myself. Could you say something about that?
Different aspects to sort of comfort your... Yes, but it's true. They know different aspects of you than you yourself experience and come to know and understand. The internal versus external, of course, those come closer together, I think, as we go through more meditation, zazen. But Yes. Everybody here probably knows me better than I know myself in some sense, particularly in the sense of being boring. But I warned you that this is not going, you're going to be dissatisfied with everything, including the answer. So I apologize.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.